I've never done an evening like this where I did the first one and the last one, and Arv did the two in the middle. And it's so interesting because he brought up how the compassion and sympathetic joy are more circumstantial and situational, whereas metta and equanimity really aren't. So I'm kind of doing the bookends a little, and they're both like bigger concepts. So I wanted to start by sharing something of what's going on for me lately that has really connected me with equanimity. I'm really dealing with a lot of thoughts and concerns about aging. Right now, I'm healthy for the most part, and I'm an old lady. And so I've got this going on and that going on. And I sit with this lovely friend, Dharma friend, on Wednesday mornings, and we sit for a half hour and then we talk about our sits. And I told her that in the sit, there was this question that came up that at this point in my life, there are conditions, kind of unpleasant or negative conditions that can't be fixed by medical intervention. And so the question that came up in my sit was, can I not argue with the manifestations of anger, of aging? Can I be with aging in all of the ways that it's showing up? So that leads to, well, what is equanimity? How is it defined? It's in Pali, the word is upekkha. It's translated sometimes to look at, to perceive, in the being in the middle of or balanced with. It often says you stand in the midst of experience and say this too. With equanimity, we stand with kind of unshakable balance. It protects the heart from the things that we can't control. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable. I love these huge words, without hostility and without ill will. And for me, my step towards it was, can I not argue with how aging is manifesting this week, this day? I might be able to change things with medical intervention, and some stuff I'm not going to be able to. There's a great story that Joseph Goldstein tells about a, I think it was a self retreat, where fear was the overwhelming emotion and mind state. And he asked himself the question, what if this mind state of fear is with me for the rest of my life? Could he be with that, with some kind of unshakable balance and poise? So it's that kind of question that equanimity brings out. Another personal story about equanimity is there's a lot going on in my life right now, a lot with my business and personally. And I took a walk. I live right near the Fremont Bridge. I took a walk the other day, and right in the middle of the bridge, I just stopped and I said, oh my goodness, I am just being pulled by the momentum of my life. It's like, who even decided to go on this walk? I mean, it was like, first you do this, and then you do that, and then you do the next thing. And I stopped and took some really deep breaths. And for me, it was like the first little opening towards equanimity. Could I just stand right there, right in the middle of this feeling of being just pulled and pushed by momentum? And could I just stand in there in the middle, breathing and not fall over? There, in the teachings about equanimity, there are a lot of different images that are presented, and they're really good. One is a mountain. You know, the sun shines on it, rain falls on it, it gets covered with snow, it's struck by lightning, birds and animals defecate on it, hikers stomp on it, nature erodes it. And what does the mountain do? It just stays there, unwavering. Solid, not rigid, but solid. And kind of continuing with that kind of image, and as Arv did with his guided meditation, when we start with our bodies and that connection with the earth, you know, just like the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by all that is thrown at it. And with equanimity, we can be more like the earth, kind of open to all that arrives. Kamala Masters tells a wonderful story about a time when she was in India, and she was on the Ganges River real early in the morning with funeral pyres on one side of the river and a gorgeous sunrise on the other. And she said, that's the place that we live, between sunrise and death. That's the place of equanimity. Another image comes from a Zen teacher, Ezra Beda. His book called At Home in the Muddy Waters is fabulous. And I love that image of being home in the muddy water. You know, lotus blossoms grow and thrive in the mud. And it's kind of like our lives, you know, where we're filled with all this beauty and the joy that Arv was talking about. And at the same time, the mud, the muck of dis-ease, of change, of grief and loss. I know I'm quoting a lot of other people, but it has all felt right to me. One of our other local Dharma leaders, Steve Wilhelm, who leads the East Side Sit, he and I did a teaching together some years ago, and I kept this quote from him. He says that equanimity is based on the insight into the nature of things. It frees us from being jerked around by the seeming attractiveness and non-attractiveness of those things. The less we cling, the less the self is grabbing onto objects to which the self is attracted, the deeper our equanimity. And compared to the other Brahma Viharas, equanimity is most closely linked to emptiness and non-self and to the realization of impermanence. You know, metta, compassion, and joy are the qualities of mind and heart that we cultivate. And equanimity seems to be more a quality that we realize. And that these other heart practices make it more possible for equanimity to arise. You know, metta, standing next to karuna, responding to the suffering, responding with wisdom and appropriate action, mudita, responding to joy. Our hearts expand with all these qualities, and with an expanded heart, along with our wisdom practices, we create the conditions for equanimity to appear. I don't know if I'm going to be pronouncing this teacher's name correctly, Bhante Gunaratana. I think I messed it up, but I like what he says about equanimity. He says, with equanimity, the mind does not have even a trace of desire to see things in any other way than the way they are. The mind is completely united with truth. You see suffering exactly as it is. You see the cause of suffering exactly as it is. You see the end of suffering exactly as it is. And the path you've been developing all along up to now, that too you see exactly as it is. It's like equanimity is walking in the world with our eyes wide open. And I think equanimity is really an entire approach to life. All of life. You know, going back to Joseph's question about fear, and what if life sends you or sends to me something that's painful and scary and unpleasant? Can we be with it? Can we be with it with not like, oh, yay, this is, you know, just what I've always been wanting, but with a caring for ourselves and those around us, for a caring for this life that has been touched by something that's really difficult. In this life, you know, this gift may mean that we can no longer do some of the things we love. Can we be with that too? You know, I'm really in this trying to understand me and the relationship with aging. You know, can I still love life even when this is not the life that I wanted? These are good questions, and I think it's pondering those questions help us find some of the elements of equanimity. I'd like to end with this poem by Ellen Bass. It's called The Thing Is. The thing is to love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it, and everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, its tropical heat thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief weights you like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief. You think, how can a body withstand this? But then you hold life like a face between your palms, a plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes. And you say, yes, you say, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. Holding life in this way, it's equanimity. It comes with that kind of, ah, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. This too. Thank you.